Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September the 5th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Peter Drury. Today's session number is DRP 2001-3, and it is titled, You're Mine. Let's listen to Peter.
My friends in the media ministry know that they can roll the tape, and today is session 3 in Bible study at Holden Village. My name is Peter Drury. I'm a pastor at Seattle First Christian Church, and this is on Isaiah 43, consistent with our theme passage for the week, from which we get the phrase, called by name. And today we look at the phrase, or the statement, you are mine. You are mine. And for those of you who were in the poetry reading last night, I've got to look and see if I see Cynthia here by chance. Cynthia gave the most beautiful poem on redemption last night. And I wish, after talking about redeem yesterday, I really wish that we just had her poetry. She was too humble. I wish she should have just stood up and said, I have a poem that describes, because she did a beautiful job tonight, redemption. This is an exciting day in our study today, because I'm just a little bit organizing myself here. I've got to get my door prizes straight from my notes from my brother. Before I really get rolling, let me just tell you why I think this is an exciting day in our study, and then also just a word about my gratitude to you for sharing in this study together. Something I said last year to this group was that it's a joy to do Bible study up here, especially because I always assume there are people in the room who are smarter than I am and who know more than I do, or who spend more time in prayer with the scriptures than I do. And it's a joy to be in Bible study together just to share, I guess, to be co-learners together. And certainly I'm in a role here kind of leading this and teaching this, but one great example was when three of you shared examples the other day of times when the scriptures exploded for you again. And I think it's really important. I said this last year, and sometimes I just make this as an assumption about my ministry, and I realized this morning as I woke that I had not said it here, that study of the scriptures and biblical interpretation is something that is open to each person of faith, to each believer. We bring both a freedom and a responsibility to the text. And we bring our own lives and our own stories to the text. And no one can really tell us. I mean, certainly a teacher in a Bible study, or John Sager in his presentation on Paul, I mean, we can maybe give some insight or some information about things. But really, the retelling of our own stories through God's stories, or the retelling of God's stories through our own stories, that's something that each one of us does individually. And that, to me, is one of the big thrills about the mystery of faith, is that God is at work in each of our lives. And today, when we look at really God saying to us, you are mine, that's not really, you know, you are one among many who I call mine, right? You're part of this whole crowd who I think of fondly, right? I mean, God's saying, you are mine. And there's a very particular claim about that. And that's what we're going to unpack today. But I wanted to be sure to state my gratitude to you for learning together, and to encourage you through the rest of these sessions to feel free, you know, when I ask a question like that, or if something occurs to you in the middle of something, you know, that if you have some insight or some angle on this that you'd like to share, please feel free to do that. But I say that not just as a matter of how I teach. That's not a pedagogical concern. Oh, gee, you can interrupt. The point is, you know, the point is we are learners together in the text. And maybe I've been asked to do a little more homework in advance to try to pull this together. But I think it's a privilege to study together. And the other nice thing is that, of course, in my home parish, depending on what I say, I could get fired. But here, you know... You know, here just at the end of the week, you get on a boat and you go your own way. And if you didn't agree with me, that's just fine. You know, so you know, we can learn together. We can take some risks together. One great example of that, and then I really am going to say a little bit more about why I think today is an exciting study. But my friend from University Place Presbyterian Church, and I need you to remind me of your first name. I'm sorry. It was a I'm sorry, Dave. We met playing bells in the chimes the other night for the opening hymn. when Gyro back there taught us all in 30 minutes how to play the chime. I mean, it was amazing. And so after ringing bells together, this morning I arrived and there was a note here on the music stand, and I'm really grateful for it because it opens my eyes to something that relates to the earlier 2 days of the study, but also to today. I guess Dave ran across a quote just yesterday, you said, right? By Oscar Romero. Do people know who Oscar Romero was and his story in Latin America? A tremendous priest who, well, I can't even describe it, but there's a film by his name Romero that's one of the most powerful, you know, it's kind of like watching that film called Gandhi. One of those just amazing things in Romero's life and his interpretation of what we now call liberation theology. I really think that Nikki really kind of preceded that term in a sense, and just really taking a good hard look at what was the gospel's call to him as a priest in Latin America, and eventually his death as a result of his preaching and his leading. But this quotation from him, this quote is from 1977. A couple days before Christmas, the 23rd of December. And I don't know what year he died. Does anyone happen to know? Is this late in his...
My recollection is it was 2 years after that, but I'm not sure.
Okay, that sounds... I was wondering if it was kind of 80 or 81 or something when he died. I'm not sure. But listen to this, because he specifically... We were talking yesterday about, again... Especially some of you will be here maybe for the first time today. Let me just say that texts are written in a context and then they reappear in another context. And that's kind of what I'm talking about in terms of the integration of our stories with God's stories. Here's Oscar Romero's words in December of 77. Let us not be disheartened, even when the horizon of history grows dim and closes in, as though human realities made impossible the accomplishment of God's plans. God makes use even of human errors, even of human sins, so as to make wise over the darkness, or to make rise over the darkness. Okay, thank you. Okay. So as to make rise over the darkness what Isaiah spoke of. One day prophets will sing not only the return from Babylon, but our full liberation. Quote, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They walk in lands of shadows, but a light has shone forth. End quote. That's text in context, right? And that has complete theological and biblical integrity. It's understanding where the text originally came from, and it's re-listening to it in another context and allowing... The phrase I used from Brueggemann earlier, the term was texts that linger, words that explode. These are well-known texts that were lingering in the tradition, but they could explode in a new way. They were explosive. Thank you, David, very much for that. That's a powerful reminder. Well, let me tell you why I think today is an exciting day. This is the one day when you get any lesson in biblical Hebrew. And don't worry, by the end of it, you're not going to know the alphabet or how to parse verbs or anything. But I do want to tell you a little bit about the style of Hebrew poetry, because the texts that we're reading are Hebrew poetry. And it's easy to think, okay, what's poetry? Well, see, there's limericks and there's rhymes and there's sonnets and well, Hebrew poetry knows nothing of sonics and limericks and rhyme. And so I want to point out one feature that is just screaming out. If you're a student of Hebrew poetry, or if you're not, let's say that you know Hebrew language and you read it, and maybe you aren't a student of it, but that's your tradition. This passage is just screaming out with a certain kind of emphasis that it's fun to kind of point out today. There's really no such thing as rhyme in Hebrew poetry. There's really no such thing as rhyme in a lot of, you know, English poetry either. I mean, we know that. Sometimes just the poems that rhyme are kind of cute that way, or sometimes it's very powerful, but tremendous poetry doesn't rhyme. Well, that's certainly true in Hebrew poetry. The first and most kind of remarkable way of emphasis in Hebrew poetry is called parallelism. And you can imagine by its word, by the term, what that might have something to do with, but it has to do with, for example, either two lines that are repeated, maybe surrounding something between them, or two lines that are repeated immediately, or two lines that are repeated with one small exception, would almost be a way of italicizing the exception. Are you with me? Mm-hmm. So there would be a parallel content in the lines. And I'd like to, we can pick this up in English. That's what's kind of exciting about this in this passage. I'd like to invite you to turn to Isaiah 43, and this time, see, you thought, because I've been telling you we're only reading verses 1, 2, and 3a. Now I'm going to have you read all the way through 7. And then I want to talk about the structure of this, because really, the unit we're talking about this week is really in 1 through 7. And I actually think this time I'm going to read it, not because I want a door prize, but but I'd like to emphasize in the reading, I mean, as a student of Hebrew, I'd like to read as closely as I can in English to how I would kind of expect to hear it, if you're with me on that. And I'm in the NRSV, so if you're in that, that's what I'm reading. It's fine to read anything else, but that's just what I happen to be reading from here. And I'm reading 1 through 7. And if you'll, you know what I'll do? And I'm going to make a couple of comments as I read through it. I think this will be the best way to do it. I'm going to read it and make a couple of comments as I go through, and then I'll go back and read the whole thing. How's that? Because then when I read the whole thing, I think you'll know a little better what to listen for. But now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel. Okay, right there. Uh-huh. I mean, you can hear that. And if you think about it, Israel and Jacob were the same person, right? Jacob became Israel, uh-huh. Right? And the name Israel means one who wrestles with God, that came after the wrestling match that Jacob had with an angel. So here's a perfect beginner in parallelism. He who created you, O Jacob, who formed you, O Israel. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name, you are mine. Now look, see what you hear that's parallel in verse 2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. Now some of us would read that and go, well, there's kind of redundancy in there, right? What feels like redundancy to you in English, if you were seeing it in Hebrew lettering and if you were hearing it in Hebrew vocalization, I mean, it's a very beautiful kind of emphatic form of emphasis. So these are not to be taken lightly. It's very clearly directed toward Jacob, Israel. It's very clearly a reminder of here's the one who created you and formed you. And then this, when you pass through the waters, I'll be with you immediately, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flames shall not consume you. So this is just, so from the very beginning, sometimes you might have just had that first parallelism that I focused on. But I mean, this passage is just, it's starting out this way, very emphatic in Hebrew poetry. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I give Egypt as your ransom, Ethiopia and Seba in exchange for you, because you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. I give people in return for you, nations in exchange for your life. Now, have you picked up, it's a little more difficult in English, but there's several words in here in terms of exchange and ransom, and I mean, that's still doing that a bit, and I'm not staring at the Hebrew text right now, but there's the implication there. Do not fear. Gosh, have we heard that? Okay. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east and from the west. I will gather you. I will say to the north, give them up. And to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from far away and my daughters from the end of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. Look at that seventh verse with me again. And think back to the beginning of the passage. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. Now, in New Testament scholarship, I don't know if we appropriate this term. Maybe someone, one of you wise pastors out there can tell me. There's a form in New Testament scholarship, we talk about the inclusio, where around the edges, let's take, for example, verses 1 and verse 7, there's a repetition, now this is more form in New Testament Greek, that then emphasizes and sets apart what's in between. Now, can anyone tell me, I mean, I'm honestly asking, and you'll really get a door prize on this, I have not heard discussion of inclusio in Hebrew literature. I mean, that's not a, shaking your head with me? I think that's right. But, in a, I mean, I've never heard that term used there. I mean, it's definitely a term in New Testament Greek scholarship. But in the Hebrew poetry, though, here you have a parallelism in the beginning and the end, right? And layers of parallelism. If you come back, think of this hand being verse 7 and this hand, just run with me for a second. And you can work your way back toward the center in a lot of parallel issues. But notice at the end, what's that distinction on naming? Before, it was, I have called you by your name. And in Hebrew, in yours, it's going to say in English, I've called you by name. In Hebrew, it says, I call you by your name. And here it says, everyone who is called by my name, whom I have created and formed. The words created and formed again. But here, for my glory and... or for my glory, whom I formed and made. So you're getting the parallel form in the beginning and end in terms of formation, creation,
naming.
But there's a twist on it. So even with, so what I realize, what's part of what's really exciting about this passage to study this today, is that you get an angle on Hebrew poetry that, I mean, if I just kind of held up the Hebrew text, and I mean, I have to, you know, we'd have to teach Hebrew language for a while to get into this, but this is a very clear example of it. So just know that in addition to, I mean, for us, I think these words hold a certain power, just in English. They're, I mean, they're beautiful words, but know that they were definitely that way, and maybe all the more so, to the Israelites listening to this poetic prophecy of Isaiah. And Walter Brueggemann, if you want to read more about this, Walter Brueggemann, he does a wonderful job talking about the poetic prophet, and he has a neat book called Finally Comes the Poet. And he really elevates the role of the poet in Israeli society, in the society of ancient Israel. And really a delightful and educational read. Walter Brueggemann, Finally Comes the Poet. He also, I have another book of his that I'm going to refer to today. This is Hopeful Imagination. But Brueggemann really is probably the best person to read, at least if you're looking for a first person to read on prophecy, a good place to start. Also, my teacher in seminary, Robert Wilson, there's a great book called Prophecy and Society in Ancient Israel, and but it's a big, thick book. My book group wouldn't read his book.
Well,
we've talked. And I'm going to assume, I mean, most of you have been with me these days, so I'm not going to backtrack a lot. So if you're here for the first time today, I believe that this session is independent, and I know that you will gain from it, but I'm not going to backtrack a lot over the first 2 days. But I will just say that we focused on God having formed us and God having redeemed us, or really forming Israel and redeeming Israel. I mean, that's important, and that's what we're talking about here. And now we're looking at this phrase, you are mine. And when we talked about the first two, we talked about this theme in 2 Isaiah of displacement and homecoming, right? Displacement and coming home. And when God now says, you are mine, very clearly this is, I think we hear that this is a text of intimacy, right? This isn't just about kind of God way off yonder who's going to orchestrate some things. I mean, there's very intimate terminology here. I mentioned yesterday that with the term redemption, and I failed to come back to this, so I want to highlight this. I was emphasizing that the term redeem in Hebrew, ga'al, is a term from family law. Well, it's important to know it's from family law and not from some other aspect of the law. Because in as redemption goes, the law allows one who is next of kin to free up the obligation of another. Do you remember when I was saying that yesterday? I didn't go back and emphasize that, but it's them presuming that God is next of kin for us, right? The fact that it's family law is saying we are in very close relationship. This is intimate kind of language. I'd like to have us go back and choose a couple of passages. One is Exodus 19, 1 through 6. Oh, I was going to read Isaiah 43 again in the way I would have read it, wasn't I?
Yes.
Okay, before you go there, let me now read it. Thanks. I don't know if you'll hear a difference at all, but let me just read it as I hear it as a Hebrew student and after having said all that.
Gee, Peter, thanks for reminding yourself to do that.
Okay. So I keep moving around because the lighting is... I want to be closer to you, but the lighting is better here, so... But now, thus says the Lord, He who created you, O Jacob, He who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned. And the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I give Egypt as your ransom, Ethiopia and Seba in exchange for you, because you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. I give people in return for you, nations in exchange for your life. Do not fear. For I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east and from the west. I will gather you. I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from far away and my daughters from the end of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. Let me just ask if how you hear that. Do you hear that any differently with our discussion of parallelism or in terms of emphasis? Sarah? Well,
something as you reread it jumped out for me was God's name, I am. And I thought, wow, where was that?
Very good. Very good. And see, and that appears all the time. And I'm glad you picked up on that. Anybody else pick up on that as that was read? Yeah, very important. It's also very important later, of course, I'm not talking about the Gospels today, but all of Jesus' work about I am the vine, you know, I am the, I mean, that's a very important alliteration, but I'm not talking about that today. So anything else in that reading? I mean, do you hear that in a different way, just knowing a little bit about some parallels? They're really very powerful words. Well, now I'd like to go back to Exodus, because one of the things I said yesterday about the prophetic tradition is that while prophecy may involve foretelling the future, it's mostly about really re-identifying with the past. In a sense, our memory helps become our future. Our memory creates our future, identifying through our past with our present to create a future. Exodus 19, 1 through 6, this is right before the giving of the Ten Commandments. Exodus 19, 1 through 6. And who would like to read this for us? Yeah, boy, in the light, I can't even see who that is. It's so funny, I've got this funny reflection out of the window, but I trust that you're raising your hand. Well, this is, Jerry's wife, and I'm sorry, remind me your name.
Georgianne.
Georgianne or Georgine?
Georgianne.
You get a door prize, Georgianne. For volunteering.
Thank you.
That's so funny, you're right in that window. I can see this hand waving, but I couldn't.
You're giving it to me before I read?
I am. Well, I was told yesterday that it had something to do with God's grace, you know, that we could. A rather wise person in the room said that the beauty of handing out the CD first, I was kind of lamenting that, is it's kind of like God's grace that you can kind of give the gift. It's up to you whether you respond or not, right? I mean, you can read or not read. That's in your hands. So. Exodus 19, 1 through 6.
On the third new moon, after the Israelites had gone out of the land of Egypt,
On that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They had journeyed from Rephidim, entered the wilderness of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. Israel camped there in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the Israelites, you have seen what I did in to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole world, or the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the Israelites."
I mentioned yesterday that that for all the prophets, there's an appeal back to the Mosaic character and prophecy. And I want to know, as you hear those first six verses, if that sounds like anything that we're talking about in Isaiah 43. Is there a connection there? Do you think that in Isaiah 43 there's reference back to anything? What do you see in those first six verses in 19? Which, remember, are right before the Ten Commandments are given. Something big is about to happen, right? Some big new instruction. And this is a kind of a preface to it. What do you hear here in Exodus? Just think back to Moses for a moment. Anybody, what do you notice?
Verse 3b, they're giving up of Egypt and the other lands as a ransom.
Okay. What else?
God is calling.
God is calling.
He's
you should be my
calling
treasure.
People who have perhaps strayed.
Mm-hmm.
As in Babylon, when many of the Israelites began to worship the Babylonian gods, mm-hmm. and needed to be called back to the mm-hmm. true God.
Mm-hmm.
He will be his treasured possession.
Treasured possession, yeah. Treasured possession. And what else? You know, there's at least one more.
Talking about keeping the covenant and obeying.
Yeah.
The eagle wings and gathering.
That's wonderful, exactly. And Isaiah likes that language, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, Isaiah likes it. Not in the particular passage we're reading, but most definitely. We all think of that great song, "Raise You Up on Eagle's Wings." And also this statement at the end of 5, "Indeed, the whole earth is mine." Right? A real close sense of ownership. Anything else?
Just kind of the formula, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the Israelites."
Right. Yeah, the form is similar. And I don't know right offhand, I don't know what to make of that, but yeah, but absolutely. So, I point this out because I don't want it to be lost on you that Isaiah is appealing to memory. I think in so many ways, I think he is appealing to memory. Much more so than he's appealing to future foretelling. Let me give you a couple more examples. I told you in 2 Isaiah that 2 Isaiah goes basically from Isaiah 40 to 55. And in the same way that we just read verses 1 through 7 and looked at what the end of this little pericope, this little section is about, I want to go to later in 2 Isaiah. And let's see where 2 Isaiah culminates as a text and see if this plays out. A couple passages in 54 and in 55. And I'm going to ask four of you to read these. One is, if someone can read Isaiah 51, 2, and 3. Just raise a hand if you'll do this, and then I'll ask someone else to do the next one. Who will do Isaiah 51, 2, and 3? Okay. And someone else, Isaiah 54, 1 through 3. Who will do that? Isaiah 54, 1 through 3? And somebody.
1 through 3.
Yep. Somebody, Isaiah 54, 9 through 11. 54, 9 through 11, Debbie. And somebody, Isaiah 55, verse 3. Who will do. Okay. I'll give you a chance to get to those. The first one again was Isaiah 51, 2 and 3. The second one, Isaiah 54, 1 through 3. The third one, Isaiah 54, 9 through 11. And the fourth one, Isaiah 55, 3. And what I'll ask you to do is, I don't want to call it, why don't you just read them? Do you know if you're the first, second, third, or fourth person based on the order of I just said? Let me say it one more time, because I'd like to just read them kind of in succession. So the first person, whoever you are, is 51, 2 through 3. The second person is 54, 1 through 3. The third person is 54, 9 through 11. And the fourth person is 55, 3. If you'll just read those out and give a brief pause between, but go ahead and read those in succession. Let's just... And remember now, this is kind of culmination of 2nd Isaiah.
Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah who bore you. For he was but one when I called him, but I blessed him and made him many. For the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and will make her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her. Thanksgiving and the voice of song.
Sing, O barren woman, you who never bore a child, burst into song, shout with joy, you who were never in labor, because more are the children of the desolate woman than of her who has a husband, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent, stretch your tent curtains wide. Do not hold back, lengthen your cords, strengthen your stakes, for you will spread out to the right and to the left. Your descendants will dispose of nations and settle in their desolate cities.
This is like the days of Noah to me. Just as I swore that the waters of Noah would never again go over the earth, so I have sworn that I will not be angry with you and will not rebuke you. For the mountains may depart and the hills be removed, but my steadfast love shall not depart from you, and my covenant of peace shall not be removed, says the Lord, who has compassion on you. O afflicted one, storm-tossed and not comforted, I am about to set your stones in antimony, and lay your foundations with sapphires.
Incline your ear and come to me. Listen, so that you may live. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David.
Okay, with the culmination of 2nd Isaiah, and in those four passages, who do we make appeals to? Who in our past do we call upon as metaphor for our future?
Abraham.
Sarah. Not Moses here.
Noah.
Noah.
David.
And David. It's interesting. I find that as a contemporary reader, I don't know if you do this, but if you sit down to read the Bible, sometimes you almost read over this stuff. It's like, okay, here's a little thing about David, or here's a little thing about... I mean, do you do that? You just kind of... And sometimes you... I don't know. It seems... It's almost like skipping over the begat sections or something in early Matthew. You think you recognize a phrase in the Bible, or, you know, oh yeah, I've heard this, sing a new song, or, you know, yada, 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 David, yada, 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 Noah. These are powerful placements in the text for the reader at the time, who, as we talk about, is displaced, is a refugee, and is having memory called upon as a way to know the future. And, I mean, just, so that's, I mean, that's, this is heavy material. This is real strong stuff. And then the language, you are mine. You are mine. Most people have a sense of growing closer, I find, to God, and maybe having this sense of intimate relationship with the Holy through some kind of adversity, which doesn't mean I don't recommend adversity to you. But people who have gone through significant adversity, and it, you know, ranges in a lot of different levels, but people who have, I think, find ways of relying on and depending on God increasingly fully. And does it not make sense that here in the community memory, that part of how we do that is going with what we already know? I mean, think about when I was talking about the texts that linger and the words that explode. Think about the example, for example, if you're lost somewhere. I know someone shared with me, I think it was a year ago up here at Holden. I think it was up here. It might have been in the parish. A time when they were lost and they were on a hike and somehow they got separated from their party and they found themselves, their anxiety from being lost caused them tremendous shortness of breath. And it was less what became dangerous was less being lost and more the anxiety and the shortness of breath. And I remember as the person was telling me this, I mean, she made that point very clearly, and she said at some point, she just had to stop and sit down because she knew that her anxiety was, you know, could be the end of her. Quite frankly, I mean, you know, that was the most dangerous thing, was her anxiety, and she began to just recite for herself the 23rd Psalm, mm-hmm. and to do it slowly and continually. And she says she doesn't really remember from there kind of what she did next and how she worked her way back, but she just allowed that psalm to be her guide. And think about the words of psalm. Who wouldn't think of the 23rd Psalm, you know, to relieve anxiety in a time like that? And because she was able to, in a sense, regain her center, she was then able to do what she needed to do, which, and I mean, the good end of the story was that, you know, she found her group or made it down the mountain or whatever was next. I think that that intimacy with God is born of moments like that. That's not to say it's not also born of moments without adversity. I mean, there are tremendous ways to grow more closely with the Holy without that. But I think it stands out for us in a particular kind of way. And so, for that reason, I think this literature from the exile is so important. In fact, if you know, you may not know what's in it, but if I refer to the Talmud, do you know what I'm referring to? Anybody know? The Talmud's one of the holy texts in Judaism. In addition to the Torah, the books of the Bible, the Talmud is all the just volumes and volumes of rabbinic interpretation and wisdom and midrash and stories around interpreting the Bible. And the Talmud, if you ever, I mean, you couldn't in a lifetime read all, it's just so voluminous, all the wisdom and commentary and all these delightful stories. Every once in a while, if you're in a synagogue and a rabbi tells a great story about, oh, when the rabbis, they interpreted, you know, this thing about the Sabbath. I mean, that's come out of the Talmud. And it's just, it's quite incredible. It's just beautiful and amazing reading. Well, we refer to the Talmud as though it's one body of commentary, but interestingly, there are two Talmuds. Did you know that? And there is the Babylonian Talmud, and there is the Palestinian Talmud. Because with the Babylonian exile, and ever since the Babylonian exile, there have been more Jews outside of Israel than within it. Think about that for a second. I mean, these are the folks who followed Moses to a land of promise, a land flowing with milk and honey. And ever since this very period we're talking about, that break between Isaiah 39 and 40 with the exile, there have been more Jews outside of that land than within it. And Judaism began to form in a couple of different ways. And there is a Palestinian Talmud, a Talmud that was developed in the land of Palestine, those who returned back, and the Babylonian Talmud in Judaism that developed, outside. And in fact, interestingly, there's a Jewish community in Ethiopia. I don't believe they have their own Talmud, but there's certainly their own traditions, and that's one of those interesting issues. Now, if you ever read in the papers, there's a whole Orthodox tradition in Ethiopia from another aspect of the dispersion, and it's been very fascinating now because there's quite a lot of contention about whether the Judaism that developed in Africa is compatible with the Judaism that developed elsewhere. There's a fascinating, sometime you'll see a news story about that. There are interesting issues that come up from time to time. So even the core of Jewish wisdom that emerged to comment upon the Bible has a version that's developed in exile, in a sense, an ongoing exile, and one that's in the land itself. It's a community of Israel, and certainly as a forerunner of our own in faith, that understands what it's like to feel disconnected, to feel far apart. It's not that the history of Israel, or for that matter, the history of Christianity, is always feeling like we're just kind of right together, close to God, and there's never any separation, right? That's not our story. That just isn't our story. So at times in our lives, when if we feel at all distant, sometimes you see those, like a sign in front of a church that says, if you're feeling far away from God, guess who moved? I like that. It's kind of cute and clever. But I mean, I think that it is our story to feel some kind of distance and to be longing to be closer. Longing to be closer. Longing to be closer. With all this emphasis upon the past, this appeal that we just read to, I mean, in terms of the memory of Abraham, Sarah, Noah, David, or looking back at Moses, do you think it's at all significant that when we celebrate the Eucharist, it begins with the words, we remember, that on the night in which Jesus was betrayed, he shared a table with his disciples? Do you think that's significant that it begins with the words, we remember? We remember. Re-member. We bring back together. This is a powerful tradition and one that I think deeply shapes our own then as Christians. I heard someone comment to me once, they said, it was outside of a church context, and they said, why do you always start the Eucharist by saying, remember that on the night when Jesus was betrayed, like we can't get over this betrayal thing, you know? And I thought, you know, like, can't you guys kind of move on somehow, you know, from that? And that was actually in some ways an interesting question. But I think the emphasis is not so much on betrayal, I think it's on remembering. And then we're remembering a context, that this came out of betrayal, but it also came out of a table of companions. And I talked as we started this study about being in a book group where we hold this book up and we figure out if it's too big or too small. But the other thing I said about our book group is that we always cook a meal that's consistent with the theme of the book. We always cook a meal that's consistent with the theme of the book. What would happen if you were to cook a meal consistent with the theme of your book? You know, it might be pasta, it might be legumes, it might be steak. I don't know what it is. But I bet everybody's welcome at the table, right? I bet everybody's invited. And that in Christianity, for all the different kinds of denominations that are out there, and this is another thing I love about Holden Village, is we come from so many different traditions. As I'm teaching Bible study, I don't know who's in the room. I mean, there could be Catholics in the room, Lutherans in the room, Presbyterians, disciples, Baptists, non-believers. I don't know who's here. And I intentionally don't ask. You know, I don't say, okay, all the Presbyterians, raise your hand, all the Lutherans. In a sense, it's really not important. And at the Eucharist, you know what? It's really not important. What's important is that we share in a sacrament in which we remember a past which shapes our future. And what we remember is that death can lead to life, that through brokenness, God can heal, right? We remember the future. It's almost like saying that the future isn't what it used to be. The future doesn't have to be what it used to be. And the future has changed in a sense because of where we've been. I was a student in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University there as an undergraduate. And when I went to study there, this was in the late 80s and the Intifada had just begun. I remember that most clearly, not because of the Intifada itself, but because of my parents and my grandparents' concern over my going there when the Intifada had just begun. And it maybe wasn't so wise, who knows, but actually it was very safe where I was. And But I went for a semester, and my undergraduate degree was in Judaic studies. I studied Judaism as an undergrad. Modern Hebrew at that time, not biblical. I took biblical Hebrew later in seminary. But I took 3 years of modern Hebrew, and I took history and philosophy and such of Judaism. And I studied there for a semester as a part of that curriculum. And when I went, I remember at that time in the late 80s, and it's something that I would probably still feel today, but at least at that point as a college student, really trying to reconcile the faith that I had in Christ with what I saw on television screens or in revival meetings or in evangelical gatherings or things that quite frankly kind of embarrassed me and made me kind of ashamed to say I was a Christian. Not that, and I'm not really confessing this to you, I'm just sharing it with you, and maybe some of you have had an experience like this where the things that other Christians are doing or saying have made you feel like, gosh, I almost don't want to toss that label out there about myself because people will make all these assumptions about me. And I felt that my journey with Christ was something very different in a certain sense than what I was hearing kind of preachers talk about on television screens or whatever. And I found that for the most part, I mean, in a group like this, I mean, generally people who are church folks in one way or another, I mean, we understand the language of faith, but for the world out there of unchurched people, good golly, we look like a pretty bizarre group of folks. You know, you can, and if the only exposure you have to church is someone saying, touch the television screen and I'll send you this piece of cloth that I've prayed over, and we'll, I mean, really, to the person who doesn't know the church, and I mean, maybe that seems like what we're all doing as Christians. And as a college student, just think now, you know, someone 20, 21 years old, discerning a sense of call to ministry, believing that God had a place for me within the church, at the same time wondering if my best witness for Christ, in a sense, was to be within the church or outside of it. And I was also contemplating going on in social work, and the long end of that story was I did both of them, and have worked both as a social worker and a pastor and continue to try to integrate those. But when I headed to Israel to study, I mean, I was really at a point of personal questioning about, is my ministry going to best be done within the church or outside of it? Can I best do what God is calling me within this institution or somewhere around the edges? So when I went, one of my goals, and among other things, I was very interested, one of my great interests in Judaism was to better understand the religion of Jesus. I wanted to understand the spirituality of Jesus. And you certainly can't understand the spirituality of Jesus by reading Paul. I mean, just for the record, you can't. Now, Paul's fine and well, but you can't get into the mind of Jesus and his spiritual tradition by reading Paul. That's later, I mean, that's later interpretation. I wanted to understand what was Jesus' religious formation and tradition. So when I went to Israel, I had decided that I wasn't going to read any New Testament texts. I wanted to immerse myself in the Hebrew text. Just a personal decision I made. I thought, well, on another trip to Israel, I'll focus on New Testament things. And I also wasn't really interested in visiting New Testament sites, which sounds kind of funny. I did it later in my trip, but again, I just thought, you know, there will be another time in my life when I'll get back to the Holy Land, and I'll do that then. But at that time, I was really wanting to better and better and better understand Judaism and to better and better understand the tradition that Jesus was raised in. So my emphasis was definitely in terms of seeing Old Testament archaeological sites, reading the Hebrew Bible, and just kind of, in a sense, putting my knowledge of the New Testament on a bit of a shelf. And I don't mean that with disrespect for the New Testament. That's just where I was. And I thought, you know, I'm going to immerse myself in this. So as the summer went along, I mean, there were different ways over times that I mean, it was clear to me. I knew that I was not Jewish. I knew that I was not a part of that community. I felt welcome in certain ways. But in certain other ways, I didn't feel welcome. I realized some of my early Shabbat Friday evenings at the university as students got paired up with families for Shabbat dinner, and I realized that I was going to be back in my dormitory alone. And also then realized, of course, that the buses stopped running and the, you know, the stores closed down, and oh my gosh, you know, how much, falafel can carry me through the weekend here. But there were ways in which I then had to shape my own experience in the context, you know, of a strongly practiced Judaism in that place. And at the end of my time there, I took some travels. The semester had wrapped up, and I traveled with a couple of friends in Egypt, and then we came back, and then I spent high holidays at a friend who was entering. He was going to become a cantor in Reform Judaism, and he was studying at doing his year at the Hebrew Union College there, where rabbis study in Jerusalem. And so I went to Rosh Hashanah services at the rabbinical school, which was wonderful, and participated in some beautiful, beautiful liturgies there of rabbinical students. It was kind of a nice, it's my only experience. I mean, I've certainly been in plenty of seminary environments, but it was really neat to be in the context of a rabbinical school and experience a similar kind of faith sharing and faith development and a sense of seeking out vocation within Judaism. And that was a rare privilege for me. But then I proceeded with a roommate of mine to travel to the north. I had not been around the Sea of Galilee yet. And again, as I say, I mean, I think in the earlier part of my studies, as I looked to, I mean, certainly in the north, there are important Old Testament, locations and allusions and such. But I think of the Sea of Galilee as being rich with New Testament kind of stories and images. So I saved that for the end of my trip. And so a roommate of mine who is Jewish, from England, from Manchester. He and I traveled a bit up to the north, and remember kind of stopping through the Sea of Galilee quickly. We knew we would come back, but it was our goal to get to the town of Tzfat, which is difficult to pronounce, Tzfat. It's spelled, in English, we spell it S-A-F-E-D, Safed, it looks like. Let's call it Tzfat. And it's a community. Does anybody know about Tzfat? It's up in the hills, kind of. If you imagine, I better stand this way if I'm going to do a graphic. If within Israel, no, I can't. I draw so horribly. I'll just do this with my hands. So I'll make it worse to draw. But if the Sea of, I'm going to do this your direction here. If the Sea of Galilee is kind of here and Jerusalem's down here, and if the coastline then is over here. So Jerusalem's here, and Tel Aviv is maybe here, and Haifa is up here. So somewhere between kind of, actually Sea of Galilee is probably disproportionate, I'll do it like that. Sea of Galilee and Haifa. There's a mountain range kind of in between there, and Tzfat's up in the middle of the mountains. And as you know from being up here, think about this morning. How many of you noticed different qualities of light this morning just as you woke up and looked up into the mountains? Mm-hmm. Or last night before you went to bed? Yeah, the light is changing constantly in beautiful shades. Well, in Tzfat, that's the case. I mean, lighting is really powerful there. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily an artistic community, and it is the birthplace of Jewish mysticism. So if you ever hear anybody talking about the Zohar or the Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism, Tzfat is the place where that grew up. That's the mystical community in Judaism, or the place of the origins of that. We got into Tzfat, and it's also, which I didn't realize when I went, a heavily Orthodox community. And I wasn't as aware of that. I think I was a little naive. I was thinking, you know, I was a kid from the Puget Sound who thought, oh, artistic community, you know, oh yeah, it's kind of casual, people hanging out, you know, crafts, sort of, you know. I really thought that one through. I thought it was just kind of, you know, it was kind of the liberals and the artists. So we got there, and we probably got there around, well, it was a Friday, and let's say it was afternoon, not quite evening, but afternoon. But now the bus schedule stops. I mean, the buses stop when it gets dark and the sun sets. But in the couple hours before the sun sets, I mean, they become less frequent, right? I mean, bus service starts to transition down. And we wind up in Tzfat, and, you know, our first thought was, hey, let's kind of run around and catch what we, you know, let's see what we can, because we knew tomorrow was going to be a quiet day. And there's quite a movement in Israel. Have any of you, I should have asked, any of you traveled in Israel? Quite a movement in Israel, especially you would notice this if you were traveling with anybody who's Jewish in your team of travelers. There's quite a, I'm going to call it an evangelical movement, not outside of Judaism, but within Judaism. And there's a desire that, for example, when American Jews or European Jews, other Jews from outside of Israel, are in Israel, and if they're of Reform or conservative background, there's a whole group within Israel who wants them to become Orthodox and is trying to pull them back into the fold. Very similar to as we see evangelical Christianity in terms of, I mean, just the very strong importance of pulling someone into kind of correct belief and correct participation in the community. And I'm not saying that, I don't mean that critically, but I think our closest analogy is the passion that evangelical Christians have for bringing folks into the fold. It's like that within Judaism, but it's not for people outside of Judaism. It's for getting those folks who maybe aren't as observant in the way that these folks think they ought to be, to get them kind of into the fold. Well, this goes to the extent where there are hostels set up where you would offer, let's say, an American or a British or, I mean, a Jew from somewhere outside of Israel, you'd offer them a place in the at the hostel, you'd have a Sabbath meal. You know, now it's Saturday, quiet day, can't go very far. And you have these deep discussions and conversations, and so David, who was traveling with me and myself, we wound up in Tzfat, and the sun's about to set, and the bus schedule is getting less and less. And we wind up going to sign up for a hostel. And we thought we would just kind of, you know, share a room there, get a couple of bunks. So we start to sign in and whatever. And at some point in the process, they learn that he's Jewish and I'm not. And suddenly there's not space for me in the hostel. And I also want to be careful in saying that. I didn't have the experience of it. I didn't feel that it was kind of a, like we might talk about racism here, where let's say that if a white person, a black person were trying to find room at the hotel and suddenly there wasn't room for the black person. It didn't feel quite that way for me, but I think what it was is, and maybe this is just because I studied too much Judaism that I had sensitivity to it, but a sense that they didn't want to kind of incorrectly proselytize me. And truly, the function of this hostel was for proselytization within Judaism. So it was more like they didn't want to pull me into something that I didn't have to or need to be a part of. I understood that intellectually, but the sun is setting and the bus schedule is reducing, and I don't know where I'm going to stay overnight. And, you know, I don't know with hindsight if I'd gone back and said, look, I don't have a place to stay. I mean, I would like to think, because in the tradition of Orthodox Judaism, I mean, there ought to be a place to stay. But at that point, I mean, they didn't want me kind of pulled into their program. So David was kind of, he wasn't sure, and he thought, well, should we leave together or whatever? And I said, no, you got a place, whatever. And I said, I'll go find a spot. So I go to try to find a spot. Well, I can't find, I mean, hey, the folks who host people in Tzfat are proselytizing Orthodox and mystical Jews. I mean, there's not just your general international youth hostel. So I get on a bus out of town, because I figure my only hope is to find a spot outside of town. And it wasn't like I brought camping gear with me particularly, so I wasn't really, but I thought, I'm either going to get on a bus that's going to take me toward Haifa, or it's going to take me toward the Sea of Galilee. And in one of those two places, I mean, they're major enough centers, I knew I could at least find some hotel to stay in. So I get on a bus, and this one's going toward the Sea of Galilee, and I'm kind of happy about that because I wanted to get back there anyway and was thinking that maybe where I would wind up. And I've got my little Let's Go Israel book, and I'm paging really quickly and in a book like that, if you've traveled in, I mean, anywhere in the world, you have one of these Let's Go, they say, well, tell the bus driver you let you off at the third tree after the second police station, and you walk a quarter of a mile down, and you'll see someone who looks like they don't know where you're going, but just go, I mean, it's kind of funny, the detail. So I had one of these descriptions of tell the bus driver you want to get off at the road marker, 7.3 or something. And I'm reading through, but there was a hostel for Christian pilgrims connected with a Church of England that was near the Sea of Galilee. And so I'm suddenly thinking, boy, this would kind of be a nice relief, you know, at least be a nice relief. I'll find someone who, you know, at least I kind of fit within the zone there. And so I said to the bus driver, okay, I need to get off at milepost 7.3 or 4.5 or whatever that is. I get off and the bus goes away. I'll tell you, I mean, I felt isolated, nothing's fine. Now I'm kind of on a, you know, on this windy road and the sun is setting and I'm going to go down a dirt road and I'm just kind of trusting, boy, I hope this wasn't a misprint and let's go Israel. You know? And so I walk down a path and I turn around. Well, and sure enough, as I get down, and I should say that in the area above the Sea of Galilee, it's very dry, kind of like hiking in the hills up here if you get into the dry air, or you look up from Chelan, you know, it's just kind of dry hills. But around the sea, very, very lush. You know, the north in Israel, especially around the sea, is very lush and green. So I'm walking into kind of a lush green area, and sure enough, I see something that kind of looks almost like an Anglican church to me, kind of down the way, and I'm kind of trusting. So I walk down the path, and I get there, and I proceed to check in, and it's the right place. Whew. So I get through that one. So I fall asleep, mostly just with a deep sense of gratitude that I've found a place to rest my head for the night. Well, so when I wake up, then I have to read and figure out, well, where am I? On the sea, you know, how does this relate? You know, where, how does this relate to New Testament sites or anything else? And joyfully, I wind up figuring out that I'm very close to Capernaum. I'm very close to the chapel that's been built at the place where Jesus apparently called the disciples to toss their nets on the other side of the boat, and all kinds of neat things on this a couple mile stretch there. And you know, so I'm a college student with my Birkenstocks. I can walk a bit, and so on Saturday I kind of go up and down this side of the Sea of Galilee, and you're kind of near as well the Mount of the Beatitudes. And there's a chapel built up there for the Mount of the Beatitudes. And so I just had a most joyful day. I mean, it was just wonderful getting from this kind of fear and panic of where do I stay? And I don't fit within Judaism, but it's what I've been studying all summer. And I'm embarrassed about my Christianity. Or I mean, not really embarrassed, but you heard what I said earlier. I mean, you know, trying to reconcile all that. I go up to the Mount of the Beatitudes. And right as I get there, there's this beautiful chapel, and it's a beautiful setting, and I've kind of hiked up a hill, the mount, to get there. And but pretty soon a tour bus arrives. And all these tourists get off of their air-conditioned tour bus, and someone's like, and on your left, you know, and on your right. And I was trying to have my contemplative moment. You know, I thought, here I am, the Mount of the Beatitudes. I just... And I wish I could remember this better, but they proceeded to have a kind of a religious service there. But I really think this was not it was not my sense that these were like deeply believing folks who were having a worship service to inspire their Christian faith journey. But instead they were trying to, I don't know, they were kind of trying to reenact something or something. And maybe it was just my skeptical college traveling self, but it felt very hollow to me. And it was, and all these folks in the comfortable tour bus, I just thought, you know, whatever. So I I didn't need to be there. So I walked on down from the Mount of the Beatitudes, and I found myself somewhere on the mountain about halfway between the between where this chapel is and where the seashore is. And I sat on down, and I was in a new kind of silence. I was in a new kind of silence. The silence before had been the silence of the Sabbath, not knowing where my home was, you know, and trying to find a place. Now I was in a silence where I had found a place, had a place to stay for a couple of days. But I'd also felt some distance with my own folks, in a sense, the people touring. I mean, the reason I was annoyed by the tourists and the buses, I'm one of them, in a sense, right? I mean, I'm a tourist in this land. I mean, it was recognizing within myself them. And then, so here I sit on this slope. There's that buzzer. And I think it's telling me that my time's up, but I'm... I don't know what that is. So here I am on this slope, very quiet in my prayer, and focusing down at the point where it is said that Jesus told the disciples to cast their net on the other side of the boat. And I look out and I try to visualize a spot in the water that is far enough out that they could be fishing, but is near enough in that they could hear Jesus call out to them. It's kind of nice that I had a point of reference like that. cut. So from that point, I just looked out, and in my prayer, I just focused on that place. I don't know how long that prayerful period lasted, but I just really focused on that prayerfully and tried to just kind of take in the spirit of that remarkable story. And at some point in the middle of that, I looked up and I had all these sheep just running right past me. I was almost in the middle of just a flock of sheep. And so all these images of the 23rd Psalm are kind of running past me. And beautiful, and just a wonderful grace. It was almost like it was a dream. And as I looked out in that space and I thought about my own spiritual journey and whether I fit within Christianity or whether I fit within Judaism or whether I didn't fit anywhere or all that, and looking at that place, I feel in my prayer, I didn't hear a literal voice, I'm not saying that, but I heard a voice in a prayerful kind of way. As I focused on the water saying, cast your nets on the other side of the boat. Cast your nets on the other side. And there was in that moment a deep intimacy of my own with God that helped me in some way begin to restructure a faith journey where I might begin to re-embrace the depth of my own Christian faith in maybe some new terms that really had integrity for me in my own journey. And I look back to that time, it would have been about this month actually, September of 1988. And the powerful nature of that intimacy with God, whether that's a conversation or whether that's a listening, cast your nets on the other side of the boat. And it was not about disciples and fish exactly. It was about me and priorities. It was about me and a focus of study. It was about me and the ministry. It was about me and a lot of stuff. But I believe there is a deep intimacy with our Lord that we are called into as people of faith. And if we will open ourselves to it, if we will listen for God's voice, then God will call us by name, and God will say, you are mine. You're not one of the masses. You are mine. That, my friends, is powerful spiritual ground. May Christ grace your steps this day, and also mine. Go in peace. Amen.